Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I love criminal ancestors. Hey, welcome to Extreme Genes, America's family history show on ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And maybe I've been talking enough about my criminal ancestors because it's spurring other people to talk about theirs. A little later on in the show today, we're going to be talking to Sarah O'Connor about her journey of tracing down a great-great-uncle who went on quite the crime spree in the Northwest. So we'll catch up with her and how she found all this out, even how she found her ancestor's mugshot. Good stuff. And coming up in about 8 minutes, very excited to do our monthly DNA segment with Dr. Joanna Mountain from 23andme.com, one of our sponsors. This is great stuff, and if you have any interest in doing DNA, you're going to want to listen to what she has to say. But first, we head to Boston to talk to the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors, David Allen Lambert. Hello, David.
Greetings from Boston, Fish.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great.
A lot of news this week going on in family history.
Oh, there really is. Actually, and this one's kind of about one of your cousins. You have a royal line, correct?
Yeah, I do. Edward the First. And I've also traced to Robert the Bruce in Scotland.
Well, we're definitely cousins through Edward the First.
Okay.
I haven't found the Robert the Bruce line yet, but your distant cousin, Queen Elizabeth II, is now the longest reigning monarch as of this week.
How about that?
Yeah, at 89 years of age, she has reigned 23,226 days, and for those people quick on the math, that balances out to 63 years and 7 months, according to Buckingham Palace. And she has surpassed her great-great-grandmother, who had the previous record, and of course, that is Queen Victoria.
Right.
Also from England, we have some earlier news. It turns out there is an earlier monument than Stonehenge in the general area. Roughly over 100 stones covering several acres was built about 4,500 years ago and is older than Stonehenge.
So, wow.
So people are digging into the past in England. I don't think they're going to find much of anything with genealogical evidence right away, but who knows what they might dig up.
And what it means, that's just the thing. What do these stones mean, and where are they facing, and what are they trying to do?
Well, you know, it's funny. I went there in 1986, and they had it all roped off, and I showed a guy who's a security guard a photograph of a guy in British Columbia that made a Stonehenge out of crushed cars. Well, he was so amazed by this, he took me under the rope and let me walk up to the monument. He goes, "See this stone right here?" And, of course, I'm casually just leaning and touching it. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, no kidding.
The thrill of a teenager. And, you know, digging into the past, sometimes our technology can be our best friend, as you realize. With cell phones and digital cameras, a trip to the cemetery is always wonderful. But how about when the batteries die?
Uh-oh.
So here's my low-tech tip for the week. If you're at a cemetery and you locate your great-great-grandfather's gravestone, write down the following compass directions. Who's to the left? Who's to the right? Write down the name of the people on the stones. Who's in front of the stone? Who's in back of the stone? And then do the northwest, southwest, northeast, and southeast coordinates. That way you know in a general area how to find the stone again.
So it's a poor man's GPS.
Exactly.
I like that.
And I don't think I'll be able to get an app for it because it's really not used when your phone is on.
All right. Now, speaking of the tech tip of the week, last week you were going to try out this new thing called PhotoMine and explain what it does and what's your review on it.
I was very impressed by it. PhotoMine for $4.99 from the App Store will allow you to take a photo album or, as I found, a group of photos, lay them on a table flat and photograph them. Now, what's neat about this, Fish, is it doesn't take a picture of everything as a collage. It zooms in on each one of the individual photographs.
Wow.
So what it does then, you can manipulate and move the bar up so if the picture is kind of at an angle, you're not just limited with square brackets to crop. You can actually manipulate it at different angles.
So to square it off or to make it look different or artsy?
Exactly. And then the great thing is that it automatically creates a folder for you, and then you can send it to social media like Facebook. So you're visiting a cousin, they pull out the photo albums, you want a copy? This $4.99 app will allow you to do that, or a pile of photographs at a historical society. You don't have much time. Boom, boom, boom. You don't need a scanner with you. I think Tom might even be interested in checking this.
Yes, absolutely. That'd be great stuff. And don't forget, when you're in your phone store for iPhone or Android, don't forget to get the free Extreme Jeans podcast app.
I use it all the time. This week, NEHGS guest users are going to get some updated databases for Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts vital records, and that includes Connecticut for Norwich, Bolton, and Vernon, and Maine for Jonesboro, Jefferson, and Saco, and Boston, birth, marriages, and deaths, 1630 to 1699. That should keep people busy for the weekend.
Boy, and anybody who's got early New England ancestry should know that the towns kept records very early.
They did, and on AmericanAncestors.org, we've tried to put all these early vital records online so people can use them, and makes it one-stop shopping.
That's great stuff. All right. David Allen Lambert, Chief Genealogist for the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors, thanks for joining us. Have a great time in Syracuse, by the way.
Yep. I'll be talking to you live from Syracuse next.
All right.
Take care.
And coming up next, we're going to talk to Dr. Joanna Mountain from 23andMe about DNA. It's coming up in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth. Very excited to have once again one of our experts from 23andMe joining us on the show, Dr. Joanna Mountain. She is the Senior Director of Research there, got her degree at Stanford University. She's been awarded multiple grants from the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health. What I'm saying is here, Dr. Mountain, you're obviously really, really smart. So we're glad to have you on the show because we have some hard questions.
Thank you. It's very exciting to be part of the show.
Well, here's the question we got from one of our listeners. I'm going to change some names a little bit so that we can get through this without identifying some problems here. She says, my question is about my mother. There is a secret about her father's identity. She was adopted, and the adoption was closed. My children came up with some health problems that helped prompt her to get a judge to open the sealed case. When she did, she found that her mother, Frieda, had Little's disease, a precursor name to cerebral palsy, and that's one reason why she had mom taken to an adoption agency. The other reason we believe is that she, Frieda, who walked with two Lofstrand canes and had a hard time getting around, much less taking care of herself, went to Washington to visit relatives, presumably an aunt and uncle, and she came back pregnant. Her family hushed this up as quickly as possible with all the relatives, including Frieda, who might know the answer, are gone. She died in 1972 in a boiling hot bathtub that a nursing home attendant didn't check before putting her in. I mean, a horrifically sad story. The writer says, my mother, Sally, didn't try to find her birth parents until 1997 after her adopted mother was gone and my children had physical trouble. She said, my mother is 70 and wouldn't mind doing a test. She would be fine with the information, even if it was the uncle or one of the children up there. She said, I was wondering, though, if the father was of the same family, would we have a double DNA line, and would you be able to detect it? I don't have any male participant to help. Is there any way this could be solved?
Well, that is a fascinating question from my perspective, because as far as I can tell, every family has a story, a mystery that they're hoping to solve. I have one of my own, and I'm hoping maybe DNA will help me solve that one. And I think this is a case where DNA might be a part of the puzzle.
Would she require a male participant in this to solve it, or could she do this with autosomal?
Yeah, so this could be done with her own DNA if she could provide a saliva sample. She would be able to have her own DNA tested, and there may be evidence in her own DNA that her parents were related to one another.
So we could test the mother with autosomal, and that would be obviously the closest person to the situation, and that would work. But you're saying maybe even the writer herself as a grandchild?
If the writer had a cousin on that side of the uncle and aunt side of the family, that would be ideal to have them tested as well.
Of course, the question, I guess, really has to do with, well, first of all, if they did a cousin test, would it work with an autosomal, or would you have to go to a Y?
There's no need to have any Y chromosome testing, and one can do that just with the autosomal or the chromosomes 1 to 22. The DNA from the autosomes, those chromosomes, is inherited from all four grandparents, all eight great-grandparents, and so on. And so you can pick up the pieces of the puzzle from the grandparents, not just the male line or just the female lines.
Right. So you could use a cousin of any type, of male or female.
Yes. And yes, any descendant along that line. So if the aunt and uncle had children or grandchildren, they would be great if they would agree to be tested as well. Then a comparison of the mother's and that cousin's DNA, or the writers in that cousin's, might provide the answer to that story. I've seen cases of individuals with that kind of relationship, because a few generations ago it seems it was quite common to have these loops in the family trees where you'd have individuals who were related who had children, and it wasn't always hidden. Sometimes it was quite accepted.
And typically you see a lot of first cousins, especially when you get back to the 1700s and 1600s.
That's when it was in my family, yes.
Yeah, yes. And I saw it in mine as well. Adoptees, they have a lot to work through. What are some of the most typical things that you come across, typical questions you get from them about this?
I actually often ask this exact question you asked. Do I need to have a male biological relative be tested to learn about myself? And for females, their own DNA can be just as informative in terms of finding biological relatives or testing hypotheses about biological relatives. So that's one of the most common questions.
Well, there's been quite a change, hasn't there, really, because autosomal now is pretty much a catch-all.
That's right. Yes, it's a good starting point. But sometimes, though, I do look at either the Y chromosome DNA or the mitochondrial DNA, which is inherited from each person's mother. Those can be corroborative evidence that will help firm up a hypothesis. You know, we have many people in this country, adoptees and others, who are trying to find out where their ancestors were from. And it turns out that a very common story in many families in this country is that there's a Native American ancestor. And so sometimes DNA can provide evidence of Native American ancestry. It kind of goes both ways. You have families who think they have Native American ancestry, and the DNA doesn't back that up. You have families who have no idea that they have Native American ancestry, and the DNA might show that that's the case.
Isn't it true that you reach a certain point, I think it's from the third great-grandparents back, where you could actually lose any trace of genetics from that far back, yes?
Yes. Yeah, so that's why I said may not have DNA evidence of Native American ancestry. You may have cultural evidence or even paper records, but it may not be retained in the DNA through all those generations.
Interesting, because it does change, doesn't it? You pick up more from one person than another, and eventually somebody's completely, essentially, out of your system, right?
Exactly. We're out of the family system at the current generation, and that's just because of the chance as what is inherited each generation.
We're talking to Dr. Joanna Mountain of 23andMe about what's going on with DNA these days. It's our monthly visit, and very excited about how some of these tests are done. I get a lot of questions myself, Dr. Mountain, about how you're able to predict what the relationships are. You want to go through those percentages and how it works?
Sure. So at very simple level, and people may be aware of this already, you get half your DNA from each of your parents. But your siblings also get half. So it turns out that you share about half of your DNA with each of your siblings as well.
Right. It's not 100%, even though you have the same parents.
That's right, because you get different parts from each parent by chance. So you may get the same segment from your mother as your sibling did, or the different one, because each parent has two copies, and they pass those on at random to each of the children. So if two individuals, we find them to share 50% of their DNA, we conclude that either they're a parent and child or siblings. But there is other evidence. Siblings will share some segments, 100%, and some segments, 50%. Some segments, they will not be similar at all.
So that's an average, right? Isn't 50% an average?
Yes, 50% overall. Now, when you get to more distant relationships, you know, grandparent, grandchild, it's approximately 25%.
Right.
And, I've compared each of my children to each of their four grandparents, because they have two grandmothers tested. And we can see there that they inherit slightly different amounts of DNA from each of the grandparents. You know, they might get more from a maternal grandfather than a maternal grandmother and so on. Some people are very interested to find that out.
Do your relatives like being part of your experiments?
My family has no choice.
Yes. You will give me some spit.
But the only male mountain with my surname was, at the time when we were doing this initial testing, was my uncle in New Zealand. And so I convinced him to send in a saliva sample, so I ended up getting my family's, the mountain lion's Y chromosome in that way. So, yes, sometimes the Y chromosome is part of the story as well.
So you can be either the grandchild to someone or the grandfather, and obviously then you can tell from the ages what it's most likely to be, so you can predict that.
That's what we do.
And,
yes.
Now, what do you do with things like first cousins once removed or second cousins twice removed, that type of thing? How do you predict that, or is it kind of an in-between thing?
Yeah, we don't say that it's in-between. Sometimes it's tricky. Some things are tricky, like uncle, niece, and half-siblings.
Yeah, half-siblings.
Those relationships will sometimes get the same amount of shared identical DNA. And then people tend to use other pieces of information to sort of conclude which one it might be.
So you use it in combination with the records, which is usually the most powerful way to use DNA, right?
Absolutely. We have customers who have no other information, and so the DNA is the first step as they try to solve this puzzle. And then others have some information already, and they add DNA in with the rest.
You know, I got to tell you, I get really frustrated when I go through my matches, and so many people either lock up their family tree or they don't have one. And I'm thinking, boy, you're really missing out on a lot of opportunities for me and yourself when you don't include
right.
that information.
Yes, many people are not as caught up in figuring out their family tree as others, and they haven't been bitten by the bug yet. Other people, they get started, and then it's a lifelong activity. So
sure.
We try to encourage people to get started on that path and just start with just the closest relatives. In theory, even from those smaller family trees, we could build up kind of a global family tree if we had enough of those smaller trees. And I find what is so valuable about all this is not necessarily finding new cousins, but learning from your new DNA cousins. You know, we have many stories of our customers who, through a cousin, learn about their biological family, or get to find out where their biological family lives or lived, or benefit from seeing photographs of that part of their family. So often it's not necessarily the meeting up with these cousins, it's learning from the cousins. And I've had that where one of my DNA cousins helped me understand where my grandmother's parents lived and were married and were born. She happened to have done the research for that part of my family tree, and we didn't know about each other until we found out we were genetic cousins. And then she said, well, I know about your grandmother, Emily Maud Alice. I know about that part of the family.
And then off
and
she went.
The information I have. Yes, and so I learned a great deal from someone who's fourth or fifth cousin, and we probably will never meet, but I will have learned from her, and hopefully I can help her out with something someday.
Dr. Joanna Mountain, the Senior Director of Research at 23andMe, thanks so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
And of course, if you have a question about DNA that we can ask next month as we get back into this again, you can email me at fisher@extremegenes.com. And coming up next, she found she had a relative who led a life of crime. But what kind of crime? She found out. You'll hear the story of Sarah O'Connor's journey in tracking down her great-great-uncle on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back. America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here with my guest, Sarah O'Connor from Lighthouse Point, Florida. I used to live in your neighborhood. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sarah is the genius behind GenieArtistry.com. She's a blogger. And, you know, I always love the stories that we stumble upon in the course of doing Extreme Genes. And, Sarah, you have one that goes back to the complete other side of the country, to the Great Northwest, involving some sibling of your great-great-grandmother. Get into this.
Yeah, so this is really a story about how newspapers helped me solve a family mystery that's over 100 years old. My fascination with my great-great-grandmother's brother, Frank Parmenter, began about 20 years ago when my grandmother passed her family history research on to me. And in the collection are several letters that she received from descendants of the Parmenters that had little tidbits of information about the family. Most of the family remained in my hometown, Centralia, but there were a few that strayed, and two, including Frank, that disappeared entirely. One letter really caught my attention. It was sent in 1980 from one of Frank Parmenter's nephews, and it gave details of all the Parmenter children, 13 total.
Wow.
And, and of Frank, he said, he was one to drink and pick fights at the local dances, and one night he was drunk and took a bicycle and rode it home to the Parmenter farm. He was sentenced to the penitentiary, and on release he came back and was told by his father that he could never return home again because he had disgraced the family.
Oh, boy.
And someone in the family saw a death notice that he had died in Canada in a mill that they suspected suspected it was murder because nobody in the family was ever contacted. And that was it. Nobody in the family had discovered what became of Frank, and it seemed like such a tragedy that he was turned away over a bicycle.
But digitized newspapers have since come along, and you got all into this. So what happened?
Well, I searched for years for information about Frank the old-fashioned way, with censuses and microfilmed records, and nothing surfaced. And I had all but given up when about 3 years ago, I subscribed to a few newspaper databases, newspapers.com and newspaperarchive.com. And on a whim, I searched for Frank Parmenter in the Washington papers between 1902 and about 1910 when he was missing from the guest list of a wedding for one of his siblings. Lo and behold, I found my first article, 1907, Bicycle Thief Caught. So the story was right.
Wow.
Frank had stolen a bicycle, and he had pawned it. Then he made off with a second one that he tried to sell to some man that suspected he had stolen it. And he was reported to the police, carted off to prison, and then released a few months later.
They were very tough on bicycle thieves back then, don't you think?
I think it was probably like stealing a car back then.
Sure.
And then another search, I located another article from April 1905. Frank stole another bicycle. And when he was interviewed, he claimed that he gets an uncontrollable urge to steal things when he's drunk.
That was the quote, huh?
Yes, yeah, so we know the cause. He served a few more months. He was released again. And I just assume that sometime between, say, April 1909 and his release, he had decided that he was going to make way for Canada after he'd been disowned. But I decided to keep digging. And I was on the Library of Congress's Chronicling America site.
That's a great one, and it's free, by the way.
It's wonderful. And I found a Tacoma newspaper from July of 1909. Apparently, Frank Parmenter was not only in trouble again, but this time he was in really hot water. He had gone to a small town, Roy, Washington, which is just north of Centralia, and had robbed the Grand Hotel.
Uh-oh.
He was caught by the hotel's proprietor stealing a suitcase and going through a man's belongings. And he grabbed a rock and he beat the poor woman senseless before he escaped into a wooded area outside of town. And the local sheriff gathered a posse of approximately 400 men and children, according to the article, which in my estimation is the entire town of Roy. and they pursued him.
Get him!
Yeah, and they spotted Frank crossing an open area. Someone fired, and they shot him in the foot. 6 hours later, they finally apprehended him, bleeding and exhausted. So he spent a few weeks in the county hospital, and then he was sentenced in Superior Court to the state penitentiary in Walla Walla. And as luck would have it, the prisoner files from Walla Walla still exist. They're at the Washington State Archives, and I was able to get a mugshot of Frank, and it is the only known photograph of him.
Wow. Is it a good one?
It's a good one. In the mugshot, he's wearing the same suit of clothes that he stole from the hotel. And in the other, his head is shaved and he's in his striped prison uniform. And it was so fascinating to finally get to see an image of the man that I'd been hunting for so long.
It sounds like you got exactly what you would want, what he looked like in normal life and what he looked like in prison. I mean, what a gem.
Absolutely. And really rich detail, a great description of all of his various scars and the length from his elbow to his middle finger and a description of the bullet wound in his left foot. It was really very fascinating. But Frank got released from prison. And I could not find anything else. I looked and looked and looked. And then one day, I happened to search a Bellingham paper, and I discovered that after his release from Walla Walla, he made his way to Bellingham, Washington, which is very near the Canadian border. He forged a telegram requesting $50 in the name of one of his old neighbors, and the telegram office suspected he was a fraud, and they alerted the police. The Lewis County Sheriff traveled all the way to Bellingham and brought him back to Chehalis to stand trial again. So I looked for the trial in the newspaper, in the local newspaper, thinking I would find it. But Frank never stood trial.
Huh.
The next newspaper I found from April 1911 had giant letters on top that were three times larger than the heading of the newspaper itself. It said, Six Break Jail. County captives break bars and gain freedom. Frank Parmenter outside steel cage. Liberated fellow prisoners.
Oh, he was like at the head of this thing, huh?
Yes. The article goes on to say, Frank Parmenter, charged with forgery, was not in a steel cage when they were locked that evening. The steel cages are located on the second story of the courthouse. Parmenter had pulled a piece of metal from the wall used to fasten the heating pipes, and with this he had smashed the locks on the other steel cages and used the same instrument as a tool to get through the wall. From all indications, the work of tearing out a hole in the wall had been underway for a day or two, and the boards had been sawed and the hole covered with paper. From metal secured in the steel cage, the prisoners had fashioned a rude saw. They used this to get through the woodwork on the inside, and with the tool secured by Parmenter, had gouged the bricks out so that they could get through. By tying the blankets together, they were enabled to reach the ground.
Wow.
So,
what a great story. But it doesn't end there.
No, it doesn't. The other men that escaped were all wanted for serious crimes, from white slavery to grand larceny. One prisoner, Jack Bendowski, only made it as far as the local saloon a few blocks away, where he proceeded to get drunk and was recaptured immediately. The prisoners were never recovered. The manhunt was called off. Nobody knew what became of them. And even though the old family letters never mentioned that he had robbed the hotel in Roy or broken out of prison, I still thought there might be some truth to the rumor that Frank had gone to Canada. So I began searching through Canadian newspapers, thinking it likely that maybe his string of crime had continued up there. My perseverance eventually paid off because one of the newspaper archives uploaded some Vancouver and Courtenay, British Columbia papers on their site. And my Frank Parmenter appeared in a search, but this time it was a death notice. So just to sum it up, Frank went straight and made his way to Shoal Bay, Canada, where he worked in a shingle mill. And on his last day of employment before returning to Washington, he stopped to pay his respects to a friend, and he had a very mysterious end. His clothes got caught in a flywheel somehow, and he was whirled around and died.
Ooh.
And an inquest was held, but nobody ever contacted the family. I sent for his death certificate, which provided very little additional information. I'm not completely convinced that this was an accident, even though that's what the official report says, but I may never be able to prove that.
She's Sarah O'Connor from Lighthouse Point, Florida. She is the genius behind GenieArtistry.com, a great site, by the way, Sarah. People need to see it. Describes great ways to artistically render your family history. She's a blogger. Sarah, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Fisher. Appreciate it.
And coming up next, we talk preservation with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back once again on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, the radio root sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's our preservation authority. He answers your questions about what you do to make sure you don't lose your precious audio, your video, your photographs, your home movies. There's so much going on and so much to talk about. And Tom, this is a really interesting question that we got from Jack Smith. He's in Indianapolis, Indiana, and he's saying, I'm going to be going to a local outlet soon to get my materials transferred, my old home videos. He said, what questions should I ask to know that these people are going to do this right?
That's a wonderful question, because there's so many people out there, whether you're buying a diamond ring or having your videotapes transferred. How do I know that this guy's legit? Because I know nothing about the industry, so I don't know what to look for. One of the things you want to talk to the people about is what kind of equipment that they use. You don't need brand names. It's just, how do you transfer my videotape to a DVD or a Blu-ray or to a hard drive? Do I need to bring in my camcorder? Do I just bring in my tapes? If I have the old VHSCs, do I need an adapter? What do I need to do? If you're going to a reputable place, you won't need your camera. You won't need your adapter. They will have all that kind of equipment. And one thing you want to remember—
Even the old ones.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Anybody that's worth their weight in salt has to be able to already have VHSC transfer machines. If they don't have them, it's like, what are they doing? Do they not do enough? Do they know what they're doing? I'd be very, very skeptical about anybody says, oh, no, you need to bring in your camera. The only situation where that differs is sometimes a camera gets shaken and it records a little bit off track, and it will play in your camera fine. However, it won't play even on our equipment, which we have the best equipment you can buy, because our stuff is set to a certain standard, so you might get wavy lines and things like this. But in this situation where it's recorded on a bad camera, then you would want to bring in your camera and tie it into our system.
And how would you know that your camera's bad or the video's bad?
Well, generally, you probably would not know if you don't have a way to play it. So what I would do is, when you take your tape in, if it comes back looking funky or something, then you're going to call them and say, hey, why does my tape look like this? It plays my camcorder. And if they say, well, I don't know, well, you probably shouldn't have gone to that place. Because what we generally like to do is, if we see that situation, we can generally tell, and we will call you and say, do you still have your camcorder? Have you had it repaired since? Because if you've had your camcorder repaired since you recorded your tape offline, so to speak, it's not going to do any good, because now your camera's back to where it should have been. So that's the best thing. Find out what you need to bring in, what they have. And another thing, which I take a lot of heat on this, but this is my opinion, the best way to transfer analog to digital is through a machine that's made specifically to transfer VHS-C, VHS, Hi-8, 8, all these different kind of tapes to a DVD or a Blu-ray or a hard drive. You can buy these absolute kick-butt Apples and even some PCs that are amazing on what they do. And so people get these little squawk boxes they pay less than $100 for.
Oh.
And they plug their camcorder into it and then plug that into a computer. A computer is not a device to turn analog into digital. So you have this $1,000 Apple computer that's just absolutely incredible. And then you have this stupid little piece of $100 equipment that's in the middle of it. You're not going to get good transfers. You need to find a person that has equipment that's specialized to transfer different media to hard drive in real time, Blu-ray, hard drive, whatever you're going to do. Because if you don't, you're going to get all kinds of problems. In audio, it's not so much because the bandwidth of audio is so much smaller, a lot less you're working with. When you get into video, you're doing tons of stuff, terabytes, gigabytes of stuff. And so when you're transferring, if there's the littlest glitch, if the computer just pauses for a fraction of a second, you might not notice it until you're looking at your DVD. You see these little artifacts that flash and stop and freeze, and it will drive you nuts because it's visual, and most people are visual people. So that's why you want to stay away from the computer way if you can.
And we're talking about this great question about how do you know that someone is going to do a great job transferring your old family videos? And because there are so many different types of old videos, as we've talked about, Tom. So what questions to ask? And you've given some great answers on that already. What else should they be concerned with?
You know, I would ask the people how long they've been in business, how long they've been in this industry. Maybe they've only been transferring tapes for 5 years, but yet maybe they've been videographer for 20 years.
Sure.
And so they've got the experience. There's people out there, and I am not exaggerating. We hear horror stories about this all the time. They go to a place like Goodwill, buy some old VCRs, buy some old camcorders, hook them up and say, hey, you know, they hang the shingle that says, hey, I can transfer your audio, video, and film. They know nothing about cleaning their machines. They know nothing about getting mold spores from one person's tape, transfer them to everybody else's tape. You got to be careful. You want to ask the questions. Ask them, how do you upkeep your equipment? What's your experience on that? What do you use?
Well, I want to go back to the mold spores there, because you've mentioned this before.
Oh, yeah.
Is this still pretty common, and where?
Oh, it is, especially places that are high humidity, like Florida.
Alabama.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Not so much in Arizona because it's so dry. And people that have moved around, these tapes may have been in boxes for 10, 15, 20 years. And there could be rodent damage. There could be all kinds of stuff. It's nasty. And I mean, we know this stuff. If we see something, we know about it. And I've had situations where something snuck in that we didn't catch. We didn't see the mold spores or whatever. There's no white dots. But when we started running it, we knew exactly what was going on. And so we threw the VCR away. We just didn't
really?
Use it anymore. Oh, yeah. Because when they get really, really bad, there's no way you're going to be able to clean them. We clean all of ours by hand. They make good quality tape cleaners. They're kind of hard to find nowadays, but you can get them to run through your machine. We don't do that. We take our machines apart. We clean all the rubber parts, all the metal parts with 90% isopropyl alcohol. We use the right kind of tip cleaners and things like that. We're always cleaning our machine because we don't want somebody else's tapes. Even though they think, oh, it's on DVD now. I don't care. Well, you don't know. Something down the road could happen to your DVD and you go, boy, I'm glad I still have that tape. I can retransfer it again. We've had people that have taken tapes into the big box stores that they get the DVD back and they look at it and say, this isn't good. And they ask the big box store, we won't mention names, oh, well, no, we did the best we can. We're professionals at this. They bring the same tape into us. We run it and they go, oh, now this is how it plays on our VCR. You know, we guarantee our work. If something's wrong with the tape, we'll do the very best we can. A lot of the big box stores won't be able to do that. And that's a good thing, too. If you ever take your tape into a place to get it transferred and they say there's all these things wrong with your tape, da-da-da-da-da-da, you can play it or you're pretty sure there's not a problem, send it to us. Let us try it. We get tapes all the time that are rejected from the big box stores. But these guys are an assembly line. All they're doing is going through,
sure.
Oh, this tape's not working. Let's pull it out. Let's pull it out. And we can transfer it.
And you got a lot of young kids often working in these stores. They're not special in this material.
Exactly. It's a 9-to-5 job for them, if even that, or it's a summer job. But we take the time to go through the whole tape, find out if we can transfer it, and we do. And it makes me wonder how many other tapes out there that these big box stores reject that people threw away that we could have transferred for them.
So bottom line is, Tom, you got to make sure you're working with reputable, experienced people, right?
Exactly. If they don't answer your questions, then go to someplace else. Check with your local guides. If you don't feel comfortable with them, write us a letter at asktom@tmcplace.com, and I'll try to help you. If you can't get anybody in your area, send them to one of our stores. We're more than happy to help you.
All right. We'll see you again next week.
Sounds good. See you then, bud.
That is a wrap for this week. Thanks once again to Sarah O'Connor for sharing with us the story of her great-great-uncle and his life of crime, escaping from prison, starting a new life, and his ultimate murder, perhaps? If you didn't hear it, catch the podcast. It'll be on iTunes later this week. Thanks also to Dr. Joanna Mountain from 23andMe for answering the DNA questions. If you have a question, just drop me a note at fisher@extremegenes.com. Thanks for joining us, and remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.